The biggest influence, I think, negatively on healthcare is the power of big pharma. And what happened is public funding for clinical and medical research declined, and the drug companies were really happy to step in and fill the gap. They now control most of the research agenda. They get to design and analyze the clinical trials. They deliver the results to the FDA and other agencies. And by the way, we know from lawsuits that have been filed against the FDA that the FDA doesn't even see the raw data. They approve drugs based on the data that has been manipulated and massaged by the drug companies and submitted to the FDA. So the FDA doesn't even bother to see the raw data anymore. And the other thing you should know about this, and you probably already do because it's talked about more now than it ever has been before, is the drug companies pay billions of dollars every year to the FDA to review their products. And the revolving door means that many times the regulator who's sitting across from the drug company executive talking about the new drug that they want to have approved may become the employer of that person when an administration changes and the staff turns over and that sort of thing. So the conflicts of interest are just rampant. Having said that, doctors base their clinical decisions on articles in peer-reviewed journals that are prepared by the drug companies reviewing their drugs. They often have ghostwriters that work for their companies, prepare the articles, and then they hire doctors for high fees to sign on as authors. And the authors of the articles don't have access to the real data. The peer reviewers don't have access to it. And so doctors are often basing their decisions on unverifiable summaries from drug companies, and most of them don't know that the summaries are unreliable. One other thing I'll share with you that we'll talk about this a little bit later, because this is all about empowering you to be smart about a lot of things. The journals these days are in the reprint business. They are not in the publishing objective information business. And by that, I mean drug companies buy reprints of articles that favor their drugs. They give those articles to sales reps, the drug reps, who then give the articles to doctors to persuade them to prescribe drugs. And so the journals have become incentivized to allow this to go on because they make most of their money from drug companies buying reprints of articles. And no drug company executive in his or her right mind is going to buy copies of articles, reprints of articles saying that their drug is useless or harmful, right? So I believe it was Lancet in 2019 took in something like 30 some million dollars in the reprint business, which far eclipsed other sources of revenue. So this is a system that's fraught with problems, and people who don't know about it often have bad outcomes by not being more wary of information they see in journals. So I keep talking about this confusion of risk and disease because they're both treated the same. Intensive surveillance, anticipatory treatment, recommended behavior change, but no focus on diet lifestyle change is not a recipe for health. So we have illness being diagnosed based on the appearance of small abnormalities, not based on symptoms. In other words, there is no, I don't think anybody speaking at this conference would tell you that if you had a headache and it didn't go away in a couple of weeks, that you shouldn't go see a doctor. That's what doctors are good at figuring out. Why do you have a headache that won't go away? But it is different to present a healthy body in a doctor's office and say, why don't you just start looking and see if you can find something? So the overdiagnosed patient cannot possibly benefit from this. It only serves to turn healthy people into sick patients. So let's talk about the new pre-diseases, which I've alluded to before. And we'll start with subclinical hypothyroidism. It's diagnosed when peripheral thyroid hormone levels are within normal range, but thyroid stimulating hormone is mildly elevated. It's a common condition occurring in as much as 8% of the general population. It's more common in women than in men. And it also tends to occur as people age. So if I were to visit a physician at my age and say, just, you know, poke, prod, take lab samples, whatever you want to do, see if you can find something, I would be in a category of people highly likely to have a higher TSH levels. In 80% of the cases, the TSH levels are lower than 10. And in most cases, levothyroxine, some type of thyroid hormone, will be prescribed mainly because medication is thought to prevent progression to clinical hypothyroidism. However, that's not true, as we'll see in a minute. Alternative doctors are just as good at promoting this. I've visited websites of some of them who say that 50 million Americans suffer from suboptimal thyroid function. Dozens of websites with lists of symptoms and online quizzes allow people to self-diagnose. One that I visited recently said that these are some symptoms of hypothyroidism: acne, lack of motivation, difficulty expressing yourself, anxiety, feeling socially distant, whatever the heck that means, hypoglycemia, muscle aches, low B12 levels, and the mythical condition referred to as brain fog, which doesn't exist outside of certain patients who have it after receiving chemotherapy. These are all vague symptoms that probably would apply to any of us on a given day, one or two of them anyway. And so that's a suggested way to self-diagnose is questionnaires like this. The conventional medical profession contributes too. And one thing I'll point out is I'm an equal opportunity critic because so many medical systems claim to be alternative, but they really operate on the same principle: test and test and test and test and identify small abnormalities or makeup abnormalities, as in what I just showed you, and then start treating people for them. The American Thyroid Association, the American College of Clinical Endocrinology guidelines recommend treatment for patients with TSH levels between 4.5 and 10, particularly if the patients have symptoms of hypothyroidism. But one of the problems I want to point out is that typical symptoms of real hypothyroidism include fatigue, weight gain, and depression. And there are a whole lot of reasons for this besides hypothyroidism. I mean, people who don't sleep well are tired. People who eat crap are tired. People who eat crap and don't sleep well and don't exercise, gain weight. So we certainly can't attribute all of that to hypothyroidism and say that people who have those symptoms should go get diagnosed, right? And by the way, the guidelines, and you can go read them yourself, show that or state that there's limited evidence to support these recommendations. And that's another pet peeve of mine. The big story is always the disease mongering story to get people to go have blood tests and find out that they have these pre-diseases. But in the fine print, it's like, well, we don't really have much evidence for this, but we still think you ought to go do it. 90% of people with subclinical hypothyroidism and a TSH level under 10 qualify for treatment, but medication doesn't improve either quality of life or symptoms. A meta-analysis of 21 randomized controlled trials, including almost 2,200 adults with subclinical hypothyroidism, showed that taking levothyroxine lowered TSH levels, but it didn't improve symptoms or quality of life. And remember the slide with my mother, and remember the slide with Tim Russert. More and more people in our country are dying with great lab results, many years before what their lifespan would have been if they were focused on self-care instead of medical attention, more and more and more of it. The largest trial was 738 adults who were an average of 74.4 years of age who had TSH levels of between 4.6 and 19.99 and free thyroxine within the reference range. And basically, at 1 year, there was no difference between those who were medicated and not medicated. So when you treat people who don't have hypothyroidism, you end up inducing problems. I mean, that's the part that's the worst about this. You take somebody who has nothing wrong with them and is based on the changing diagnostic parameters, because the drug companies help with that, shows a small abnormality, or the lab results are being looked at without any consideration for the age of the patient because they're the same no matter what age you are. And so what ends up happening is we take a healthy person and treat that person. It isn't just that they weren't sick in the first place, it's that the treatment makes them sick. And so people who don't really have hypothyroidism can end up with atrial fibrillation and bone fractures and that sort of thing. So it's a lot of harm without much upside benefit. The mythical disease of prediabetes, which is defined as a condition in which blood glucose levels are high, but not high enough for people to be diagnosed with full-blown type 2 diabetes. The Centers for Disease Control, which likes to declare everything an epidemic, says that prediabetes is becoming an epidemic, and they estimate 86 million people, one in three adults, has it. And I guess that would be a sign that probably something's wrong with this theory. And it is, because we have the lowest threshold for diagnosing prediabetes in the world. And so We, you know, and again, the drug companies get involved in determining what is going to be the benchmark for determining somebody who needs treatment versus somebody who doesn't. And over the years, the American Diabetes Association, a lot of these disease groups, the American Heart Association, American Diabetes Association, et cetera, they're heavily subsidized by drug companies and big ag and food companies. So the ADA lowered the diagnostic threshold for prediabetes, and by 2010 defined it as fasting glucose of 100, A1C of 5.7. And again, there's no consideration of the fact that as people age, those numbers are going to spike up a little bit anyway. And in its most extreme ridiculousness, I'll give you an example from one of a longtime wellness forum member. This happened when this woman was in her mid-70s. She was like 74 or 75. She and her husband had been, they've been eating a vegan diet for most of their adult life. They were in excellent shape. In fact, they were still fully employed as exercise as trainers, and they taught aerobics classes in their mid-70s. And they also did some health coaching to help people change their diet. And she was diagnosed with prediabetes because her fasting glucose was 109 and her A1C was 6. And so, when you take a lean vegan woman who's teaching exercise 6 hours a day for a living and tell her she's a pre-diabetic, I mean, she was smart enough to know that that was ridiculous and walk out of the office. But a lot of people don't know this kind of thing and they get sucked into the medical mill. Even the World Health Organization said in 2006 that the American Diabetes Association had gone off the rails. If you applied our criteria in China, China would have 493 million new pre-diabetics in the country. And most countries can't afford this. Only in the United States do we print money to finance the healthcare system, so you can have an almost unlimited number of people being diagnosed with fake diseases. Studies show that only 5 to 10% of these pre-diabetics progress to diabetes. About half of them have their glucose levels return to normal over time. And so we shouldn't even have this pre-disease category. And by the way, this is another pet peeve of mine. When an abnormality is detected, a lot of times your lab results change from day to day. So you should always test again. What you're really looking for with blood tests is you're looking for huge abnormalities that persist over time, not these tiny little abnormalities. So the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends that we stop screening for type 2 diabetes in populations in the general population. They analyzed the Cochrane database, Medline, previous task force reviews, and they said there is absolutely no benefit to screening people for prediabetes and to treat and prevent or prevent full-blown diabetes and reduce mortality. And I think this is the best line of all. I love this. And I hope you can follow the logic. The United Kingdom and the National Health Service, the NHS has been bankrupt for a long time. So they are very particular, much more discerning than we are here because they have to be in terms of what they do to people. And this is what they wrote about our process here. The US Diabetes Prevention Program results imply that you can give an at-risk person with prediabetes 100% chance of using metformin with the goal of reducing by 31% their risk of developing a condition that might require them to use metformin. And I mean, you can hardly say this without laughing out loud, but it's not funny. I mean, really, it's not funny when you start taking healthy people and giving them drugs because you've diagnosed them with fake diseases, and these pre-diseases are fake diseases. So some potentially harmful screening programs that you want to think about: mammograms, the risk of being harmed is far greater than the chance of benefit. Thermography is not better. In fact, it shares some of the problems with mammography, which is you find increasingly smaller and smaller abnormalities, and you end up calling them breast cancer. PSA testing, the risk that a man will be harmed rather than saved by PSA testing and core biopsies is 30 to 100 times higher than the chance of benefit. Harm is extraordinarily high. Colonoscopy, the first, by the way, colonoscopy became a standard screening procedure in most countries without any evidence that it worked in the and the, for reducing the risk of dying of colon cancer. And the first randomized controlled trial wasn't published until October 2022, and it showed that there was absolutely no benefit. Colonoscopy did not reduce the risk of colorectal cancer, dying of colorectal cancer, or all-cause mortality. DEXA scans diagnose aging, right? We lose bone mineral density as we age, women more than men, because the demands on the skeleton having babies and breastfeeding are significant. And so we will lose bone mineral density as we age. So that's what a DEXA scan diagnosis is, aging essentially. And I'm assuming everybody in this group is smart enough to know if you're getting older or not. If you're not, I don't think we can help you here. Lung cancer screening, thyroid cancer screening, which has become a big business. And what's being diagnosed most of the time is nodules, thyroid nodules, which almost all people over the age of 60 have. Mental health screening, calcium scoring for heart disease. A lot of this is just disease mongering. So these are things that you should read about and really carefully consider before you have done to you when you're in a healthy state. Principle number three, beware of the incidental loma. And this is what happens when you start looking for cancer. I alluded to this a little bit before. So the conventional definition of cancer is a neoplastic disease, the natural course of which is fatal. Today's definition is cellular abnormalities that have all kinds of different causes. And so the good example would be thyroid. Most people 60 or older have at least one thyroid nodule. It's very rare for these to become cancerous, but they make people nervous. And that's the true definition of an incidental loma. It's an accidental finding, often when you're looking for something else. So we get these detailed images of the brain and the abdomen and the pelvis, and then we find little things that suggest the potential for cancer. And the accidental finding is the one you have to be the most careful about. I remember many, many years ago, my dentist years ago was he had pneumonia. They got an X-ray. They found a suspicious spot on his lung, and then they decided to biopsy it. And the biopsy of your lung is really an incredible procedure. There better be a really good reason to do it. He was off for 8 weeks. He couldn't run his practice, and so that's an incidental loma. So the more screening you do, the higher the risk becomes. And this is one of the ways in which we turn healthy people into sick patients, and we diminish their quality of life. We were talking about this last night. I was in a panel discussion with Dr. McDougall, and one of the questions was, what are some of the damages, what some of the negative side effects of all this screening and diagnosing people with cancer who don't have it? One is the psychological damage. One very interesting study that I read many, many years ago compared the psychological state of a person who was told they might have cancer and didn't end up having it versus a person who really had cancer 3 years after the event, where the person was told they had cancer or the person was told you might have cancer. And the psychological stress levels were just as high for both. So you've got that. And then, of course, overtreatment. A 2016 analysis concluded that none of the most commonly recommended cancer screenings reduced all-cause mortality. And that's the only reason to do this, is to reduce your risk of death or something serious happening. So I mentioned the colonoscopy, which became a standard screening test. The first sign that there was going to be some acknowledgement that this wasn't a good idea was the Canadian Task Force on Preventive Healthcare in 2016 took it off the standard screening schedule, saying that there just wasn't any evidence to support it. And then, as I mentioned, in October of 2022, we finally got a randomized controlled trial study published based on a randomized controlled trial. And the data for 84,000 participants. And by the way, the subjects, this took place in Scandinavia, where they keep very, very good data on citizens and their health status. The study was well designed. And basically, what they found is this: the risk of colorectal cancer, in order to prevent just one case of colorectal cancer, 455 people have to be invited to screening. And by the way, if you've ever had a colonoscopy or known somebody who did, you know this is not a minor procedure. And there's a risk of a colon tear. Some terrible things can happen as a result of the procedure itself. So we got to do this 455 times just to prevent one case. All right. Risk of death, 0.28% in the colonoscopy arm, 0.31% in the usual care arm. It's statistically insignificant. Risk of all-cause mortality, again, no difference. It did not make a difference in outcomes. Today, it is still promoted as the standard screening tool. And when you're 45 years old, you start getting nagged about it. And some of you, if you have good insurance, which I think sometimes is counterproductive because then they know they'll get reimbursed if they do this stuff to you. I get notices all the time. It's time for this test, for that test. I don't know how I would have time to have a job if I complied with all the times I'm invited to come to a doctor's office for something I'm supposed to do at this age. So there's really only one population screening test that's been known to reduce the risk of dying from cancer, and that's Pap tests, which really have reduced the risk of dying from cervical cancer. Mammograms don't reduce the risk. To save one life, 2,000 women have to be screened annually for 10 years, and 10 women are going to have unnecessary and potentially life-threatening overdiagnosis and overtreatment as a result. Conclusion: there is no reliable evidence from large randomized trials to support screening mammography at any age. The first randomized controlled trial regarding colonoscopy, I just showed it to you. It doesn't reduce the risk of colorectal cancer or death from colorectal cancer. So the bottom line is that all of this energy and money we spend on screening, it has cancer screening, it has a really deleterious effect in two different areas. One is it makes healthy people into sick patients. It profits the system and not the patient. We have a lot of people who think they're cancer survivors who never had cancer over treatment. But the other thing is that this early detection saves lives mantra has been repeated so many times that a lot of people believe it. And it distracts from the thing that really would save their lives, which is to change your diet and lifestyle habits. I think if the medical system would just get honest and say, other than Pap tests, we don't have any way of finding cancer early to keep you from dying from it. So you better take care of yourself. And I think that would be a message that maybe would not be so well received in the beginning, but at least it would be honest. All right. So principle number four, alternative medicine is not always better. The same shortcomings that I've been describing often exist in the alternative system: excessive testing, addressing symptoms instead of causes, more questionable diagnoses, alternative tests and supplements instead of drugs. And one of the arguments that I've had from people who say, "Well, you're missing the point, Pam. It doesn't hurt people as much as the conventional system does." And I think to myself, I think that the goal of healthcare is supposed to keep people healthy so that they live long lives, not to hurt them less. I mean, can you imagine if you pulled up into my parking lot in Central Ohio and said, "Wellness form, we hurt you less than the other people do"? What an advertisement that would be. I mean, I don't really think that's what we're supposed to be doing. So I want to talk a little bit about dietary supplements because I think there are a lot of misunderstandings about them. And the first one is natural is a misleading term on labels because supplements are made in factories and they're chemically identical to nutrients. And by the way, one of the reasons is there's not enough food on the planet grown. If we took all the plants on the entire planet that we grow, and we allocated them to the supplement industry, and none of us could eat any of them, there wouldn't be enough food to make the supplements that are sold every year on the planet, right? So we make supplements to look like, and we'll often start with a food source. I'll show you that in a minute, using heat, acid, pressure to rearrange a couple molecules into a vitamin-like supplement substance. But from food source really means that the process starts with an ingredient from food. So here is an example of how vitamin C is often made. You start with an ingredient which is commercially made sorbitol, and sorbitol is a sugar alcohol that comes from fruit, corn, seaweed. So that's your food source, right? Fermentation with bacteria turns it into sorbose. Another fermentation step turns it into 2-ketogenic acid. And then that's treated with hydrochloric acid to form crude ascorbic acid. And then we filter it, purify it, mill it into fine white powder to be put in pills or added to cereal. And we label it from food source. And so, is there a place for vitamin C in some treatment protocols? Yes. But people popping vitamin C pills all day would be much better off eating it in food. It's difficult. This is another issue with dietary supplements. It's very difficult to measure the nutrient status of humans because our human biochemistry changes from minute to minute. The blood tests aren't standardized and vary from lab to lab. Some nutrients are stored in inaccessible places in the body, and you can't quantify stores. That's one of the problems with vitamin D, by the way. Plasma levels vary due to season, recent food intake, time of day the sample is taken. This is not a very scientific process at all. There are large research gaps regarding the effect of supplements on health. No tolerable upper limit has been set for many nutrients. There's almost no research on the various combinations. So people will come into our office taking 14 supplements, and nobody knows what the interactions of those supplements are. And no research really on long-term use of supplements. And so I have a very contrarian view about this compared to many of my colleagues. I think the ones you have to be most careful about are the ones where we know that they work. And the reason is because if there's an effect, there will be a side effect. And the question that all consumers should be asking about any healthcare is the benefit I'm going to get worth the side effect I'm going to endure, right? So that's what should happen when you take a drug. All right, I'm going to take a drug for whatever condition is wrong with me. Am I going to benefit enough to make the side effects worth it? So I want to talk about vitamin D because I think this is the next catastrophe that's going to happen in medicine. It's a hormone. The medical definition of a vitamin is any group of organic compounds that are essential for normal growth and nutrition and are required in small quantities in the diet because they cannot be synthesized by the body. That is the medical definition of a vitamin. The definition of a hormone is a substance produced in one organ of the body and carried via the bloodstream to another organ in the body. So vitamin D fits the description of a hormone, but it's classified as a fat-soluble vitamin. It's produced in response to sunlight, and it doesn't need to be consumed in food, which is really good because there's very little vitamin D to be had in the food supply. The photoproducts produced by the sun include not just vitamin D. You produce nitric oxide and 10 other compounds with anti-rachitic characteristics, many forms of vitamin D. There isn't just D3, 1 through 10. We know of 10 different types. We measure vitamin D status with a blood test, and it's a marker for vitamin D produced via sun exposure or consumed in foods and supplements, but it's not clear that vitamin D is a marker for health status or that increasing levels is a measurement for health improvement. And the other thing is we store vitamin D in the tissues and fat in the body, so the plasma levels tell you nothing about that. And we have people taking increasingly, I think, dangerous amounts of vitamin D without any consideration of what's being stored and where. The vitamin D craze, really, you can trace it back to a doctor in New York who ginned this up on his own and got a lot of people to buy into it. And we have incessant testing now, and the changes in the reference ranges. I remember when 10.5 was normal a long time ago, then it was 20 to 30, and now it's 50 to 100. Everybody's deficient. The error rate on the tests is between 60 and 80%. For a whole lot of reasons. I mean, I have like 4 hours of vitamin D slides, and I'm just giving you an overview here. But I'll share with you a case report, and I think this explains best the craziness about all this vitamin D testing. And there are many of these in the medical literature. This is not an isolated thing. The case report showed that the time of day the sample is drawn affects outcomes, first of all. And then all kinds of factors, except for vitamin D intake, affect levels. So, this healthy woman in her 40s was taking 5,000 international units of vitamin D daily at midday for over a year. Her plasma levels were 60 inside the increasingly insane reference range. She lived in California, got some sun in the morning. She didn't really take in vitamin D from foods. Nobody does because it's not in food, unless you're eating fortified foods. And let's get back to whole foods. Her plasma levels were tested 3 times a day, and at midday, they were 20% lower than they were in the morning and 13% lower than at night. So the first thing is I've never read a study where the time of day that the sample was taken into consideration. Her vitamin D levels fell by 25% the day before she contracted a cold, in spite of continuing to take the supplement, which is consistent with reverse causation. I'm going to show you that in a minute. And then her levels returned to baseline 2 weeks later without any change in the dose. So you can see that taking vitamin D had nothing to do with any of this. And this confirms previous studies showing that lower levels of vitamin D are a consequence, not a cause of disease. Time of day matters when you're looking at the person's blood levels. And supplementation has little to do with status. So taking the supplement didn't prevent the cold. or didn't keep her vitamin D levels at their previous level. She got the cold, vitamin D levels went down, she returned to normal, and the vitamin D levels went up, and the dose of vitamin D didn't have anything to do with that. So what we know now is that low levels of vitamin D are not the cause of disease, they're caused by disease. And so a very good example of this, and I'll show you another one, it's even more crystal clear in a second here, an analysis of 290 prospective cohort studies and 172 RCTs, randomized controlled trials. The cohort studies showed an association between lower vitamin D levels and conditions like infectious disease, diabetes, et cetera. And one of the worst problems in medicine right now is taking associations and inferring cause and effect relationships. An analysis of the intervention studies showed no benefit. In other words, if low vitamin D levels were the cause of disease, giving people vitamin D should help them, but it doesn't. And so we see that lower vitamin D levels are associated, keep that term in mind, with so many different conditions, which that should tell you something right there. What's happening when people get sick, their D levels go down. All right. And that's why when you give them vitamin D, it doesn't seem to help them get better, because if they got better from the disease, the vitamin D levels would come back up. So it's most likely disease-related inflammation that is causing vitamin D status to be reported in such a wide range of disorders. And after looking at hundreds and hundreds of studies, this group advised against supplementation with vitamin D, and I do as well. So here's a crystal clear example of what I'm talking about. Lots of this type of thing in the medical literature. 88 patients arrived in an emergency room with acute hyperglycemia. They were tested for vitamin D at admission, and then after their glucose levels were normalized 12 to 18 hours later. When they arrived at the emergency room, their vitamin D levels were an average of 12.3. And when their glucose levels stabilized, it went up to 28.3. So giving them vitamin D wouldn't have helped them. And if you gave them vitamin D, then the vitamin D advocates would say, well, that's why their glucose levels returned to normal. That's had nothing to do with it, because the treatment that they received to get their glucose levels normalized would have returned them to normal. So sunlight is the cure. I mean, and part of the problem with this is not only that this is essentially a hoax, that's what I call it, a vitamin D hoax, but it's caused people to think that the secret to health, slather yourself with sunscreen, stay out of the sun. Even if you walk to the mailbox, you're in danger of damaging your sun skin or getting skin cancer from sun exposure, and sit inside and take vitamin D3 pills. And it's a terrible, terrible, terrible practice. So the cure is sunlight. Get out in the sun. A study of MS patients and controls showed that increased sun exposure led to less neurodegeneration, increased gray matter volume and whole brain volume, independent of the vitamin D levels, had nothing to do with it. And the reason is because sunlight has such a huge effect on so many things in the body, not just vitamin D levels. And so a multiple sclerosis patient would be better off with a lower vitamin D level and more sun exposure than higher vitamin D levels from supplementation, which has no effect on MS or any other condition that we know about, with the possible exception of rickets. But hospitals used to have sun decks, and kids with rickets used to be stuck in the sun until they got better, and then they got sent back home. So it's only been since this entire thing got invented a few years ago that we've gone off on this tangent. Women who avoid the sun have a shorter life expectancy than women who don't in a dose-dependent fashion. Sunshine even offers protection to smokers, and I'm certainly not advocating smoking cigarettes and getting out in the sun to counter it. But the bottom line is avoiding the sun is a risk factor for death of a similar magnitude as smoking. So anyway, vitamin D spans alternative medicine, conventional medicine. There's really no category of practitioners that aren't promoting it. But I have hours and hours and hundreds of references showing that it's a misguided idea.